Good morning. In the last 2 weeks, we've been looking at the Christian in the government. Our first lesson dealt with our responsibility to the government, and there are probably 8 or 9 major passages that deal with this subject just in the New Testament alone. But we were centering most of our study on the book of Romans, chapter 13. And basically the lesson was to respect the government officials, and pay your taxes. That's the gist of that first lesson. The second lesson was dealing with Christian capital punishment. There are those who oppose capital punishment, as you well know, and I don't know, maybe someone here opposes capital punishment. It's a matter of one's own conscience, I suppose, but one ought not to conclude that it's wrong for a government to practice capital punishment, because I think we can show, and I think I have proved, that the government has the authority. That authority comes from God to practice capital punishment. So we were discussing that in our second installment, the Christian and the government. Can the Christian go along with the practice of capital punishment? There's an important principle that is set before us, that I set before us, and it comes from the scriptures. And that's this, that whatever it is that God has done, whatever it is that he ordains, is morally correct. If it is the case that God has ordained the government, and he has, then the government to exist is morally correct. If whatever God has ordained that the government, or authorized the government to do, that is morally correct as well. And since it is the case in Romans 13, verses 1 through 7, that the government is authorized to bear the sword, punish evildoers, to put to death evildoers, then that is a moral action. And although some would conclude, but the Bible says thou shalt not kill. Yes, the Bible does say that. More correctly, the Bible teaches in that commandment, thou shalt not murder. That is the more accurate rendering of that passage, of the meaning there. Because obviously, God is not inconsistent. He's the one who said thou shalt not kill, as we would know it in English. And yet he ordered the death of many thousands of people in the Old Testament, and certainly authorized death of others in the New, in Romans 13. So we have to keep in mind that unauthorized death is murder, and that we're not allowed to be involved in. But the practice of capital punishment is that which is authorized by God. Therefore, it is a moral action because of two reasons. Number one, the innocent need to be protected. And number two, evil needs to be taken out of our society. This is God's ordination. Then the next question was, with regards to both of those, what role does a Christian have in all this? And I think it can be summarized very simply that a Christian is to do whatever God has authorized in word or deed. Colossians 3:17. We must have God's authority. And if God has authorized the government to exist, a Christian can be a part of that. If the government has authorized if God has authorized the government to practice capital punishment, a Christian can be involved in that. By that I mean you can serve on a jury. You can vote for a death penalty of an evildoer. You can be a judge. And you can even condemn a prisoner to death as a judge if we were to take and be consistent with what the Bible teaches about Christians being involved in moral works. Now, today then, this enters into the next question, or many times it does, and I'm going to take it this direction, and that is, what about pacifism? All right. Pacifism, if you're not familiar, surely those of any mature age know what pacifism is the doctrine of the teaching that says we can never, ever lift a finger against a fellow human being. We can't be involved in any violence of any kind. The pacifist is one who will allow all sorts of ungodly behavior and actions to be perpetrated against them, and never raise a finger to protect themselves from that, or to prosecute those who may have done so. This is a teaching that is, in my judgment, a misunderstanding of some passages in the scriptures, two of which Brother Hubert read for us in Matthew 5. And so we're going to discuss this question about pacifism. What is it that God says about pacifism? The text, of course, from our reading is Matthew chapter 5, verses 38 through 45. And I want to start with this question. Does God demand that we seek peace at any cost? By the time we answer or get to the end of this lesson, you will know the answer. I could answer it right now, but I don't want to just simply say yes or no. I want to prove the case. If so, if it's true that God demands that we seek peace at any cost, then what does Ephesians 5:11 mean? There we're told, have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather even expose them or oppose them or show them for what they really are. If we're to have peace at any cost, maybe it's better that I don't oppose evil things, because after all, that would go beyond simply peace at any cost, and it may require something of me. So let's just do the best thing, the easy thing. Let's not rock the boat. Let's not cause trouble. Don't cause waves, and just let evil have its run, have its way, have its reign. Why does 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 3 and 4 happen? Peter is writing to those in the dispersion who have come out of the lusts that are in this world through obedience to the gospel. They've been begotten again through a living hope through Jesus Christ. These people are different. That's you and me. We are different from the world now, different from the world. And in verses 3 and 4 of that chapter, he says, there are some that think it's strange that you no longer run with them in the same degree of dissipation. You're not involved in your wine bibbings and carousings and lasciviousness and lusts and so on and so forth. They think it's strange that you don't run with them any longer. Well, now, wait a minute. If we're to seek peace at any cost, the world shouldn't see any difference in us. If we're going to continue to just go along to get along, the world shouldn't see anything different in you. But Peter says something has to be different here. And so what about this peace at any cost? In Matthew chapter 5 and verse 9, you know, this Matthew chapter 5, part of the Sermon on the Mount, he's talking about Christian attitudes that we must have as members of the kingdom. Verse 9 would tell us, blessed are the peacemakers. Now, we know that that's true. We're blessed to be peacemakers. And in fact, we should work for peace and work toward peace. And I appreciate Brother Steve upon occasion will mention in his prayers that the leaders of the nations will sue for peace and not for war. And that's a good thing to pray, and that's proper. James would address this as well in James chapter 3, that we should be seeking after peace. And yet Romans 12:18 tells me something. He says, if it be possible, as much as in you lieth, be at peace with all men. But what if it's not always possible? Not everyone is going to want peace. It's not always possible to have peace with some people. What do I do then? Peace at any cost. I wonder. I want you to give this thought a bit of caution here. And that is Romans chapter 12, verses 9 through 21. We're not going to read that whole text, although we will refer to a couple of the passages. It's not the same as Romans 13. Well, of course it's not the same. Well, what I mean by that is that they're not dealing with the same context or application of the doctrine. For example, in Romans chapter 12, he says, avenge not yourselves. Don't take vengeance. Basically, it forbids vigilantism. But in Romans chapter 13, it says, be a good citizen, pay your taxes, and the government will have the right to practice capital punishment. And as a Christian, in a moral action, you can be involved in that through the proper channels. But yet in chapter 12, he says, don't take vengeance. So which is it, to avenge or not to avenge? That is the question. But we need to understand these are not the same situations, chapter 12 and chapter 13. Chapter 12 is dealing with an individual duty. It's dealing with insults, not injury. He's not dealing with some thug who's going to kick in your front door and beat up your children and steal your money and maybe shoot you. That's not what that chapter's dealing with. It's dealing with people who are going to make fun of you, ridicule you, maybe even persecute you because you're a Christian. Consider Matthew chapter 5, verses 38 through 40. How is it that you could do good to your enemies, that's Romans 12, do good to them and feed them and someone, give them a cold drink of water, Romans 12, be good to someone who is your enemy, he says there. Matthew chapter 5, verse 38 through 40, how are you going to do good to someone and feed them and offer them comfort and so on, who's beating your son, who's raping your daughter, who's about to shoot you or stab you? How do we do this? Well, obviously we can't. That's because this passage telling you to be good to your enemy is not applicable to the one who's trying to kill you. It's someone who's persecuting you, someone who's making fun of you, someone who's trying to get you in an awkward situation because you're a Christian. Those are two different things, brethren. This text does not apply to thugs and bullies and their violent actions upon you. Chapter 13 is a collective duty. Again, chapter 12 is an individual duty. How shall I behave towards people around me? Be at peace with them. But not all of them are going to be at peace with me. Chapter 13, obey the government. Pay your taxes. And follow in the things that they've been authorized by God to do. Not all governments will do that. You know that. Some governments are oppressive. Every day we hear more and more in the news about what's going on in Tehran, don't we? We hear a little bit, just a little bit, of what our nation says about that, what our president says, what the Prime Minister of England has said. The President of France has responded to some of the things that's going on there. So we have a response. But we hear more and more of that government. And just this morning on the news, I saw the government officials kicking in the doors of its citizens, trying to arrest them or beat them or even worse, kill them. And so not all governments are going to do what God authorized them to do. See, some governments are acting like tyrants. God did not authorize that. Chapter 13 is a collective duty for all Christians and how we can fit in. Here's some errors that come out of Romans chapter 13. Here's what some contend, and notice the quotation. God gives the government the right to bear the sword, but Christians cannot be a part of that. You may know or have heard of Brother Wayne Jackson. Wayne Jackson is a sound brother in many respects. There's a number of things I disagree with him about. Publishes Christian Courier, is that correct? Christian Courier is out in California, as I recall, out there. But he believes in and teaches pacifism. He says a Christian can't be involved in some of these things. Others will say, and I'm not quoting him, I'm just saying that's typically what a pacifist will say. Others will say it does not matter that a non-Christian is a government official and may need to put a murderer to death since the non-Christian is already in sin. Now, what does this imply? Now, keep in mind, they're saying, okay, so the government can practice capital punishment, but a Christian can't be a part of that. But what about those people who are in there? Well, they're not Christians anyway, so it really doesn't matter what they do because they're already lost. Now, wait a minute. What is this implying? This is implying that the death of a murderer is immoral. That putting him to death is a sin. Does God authorize sin? No. It implies God has two sets of morality for mankind, and that's not true. It's not true. How can it be that what God has ordained be sinful? That just doesn't follow. Does God sin? Is he immoral? Why would he say put the life taker to death if that's an immoral action? Remember James 1 verse 13? Remember what James said? That God does not tempt any man to sin, neither is he himself guilty of sin. He tempteth no man. He does not cause people to do that which is sinful. He would not authorize something that's sinful. God has never asked nor used anyone, sinner or saint, to do something sinful or immoral. Hear that again. God has never used any of his people, the saints, or any other nation, the sinful, to do something that is immoral. Did God use Pharaoh? Yes. Did God use the Syrians to punish his people? Yes. Did he use the Assyrians? Did he use the Romans, the Babylonians, the Greeks? Did he use these nations to help discipline his people? Yes, he did. Does that mean that those actions were wrong or immoral? No, it's what those people needed at that time. God has never asked anyone to do something that was immoral. Ever. Never. Please keep that in mind. The death of a murderer is not a sinful thing. It's justice. In the last lesson, we showed that what God has ordained is moral. The government is God ordained. Therefore, the work in the government is a moral occupation. I've already made that point. But here's a question. How can it be morally correct for a Christian to call upon an immoral person to do what's immoral for the Christian to do? For example, your house is being broken into. Somebody is tearing at the back door. But the pacifist says, Christian, you cannot be a part of the government. You can't be a soldier. You can't be a policeman. So that Christian can't do those things, but he'll call up the phone and dial 911. Somebody's breaking in. How can a moral person, a Christian, call upon an immoral person, the policeman, allegedly, to do what's immoral? Come and stop that bad guy from committing a sin. See, something just doesn't follow there. How could an immoral person be qualified to do a moral work, yet a moral person, you or me, we are not qualified to do the same moral task? This is contradictory and irrational. Hear that again. Here's an immoral person, the policeman, the soldier, according to the pacifist point of view. He's not a Christian, he's a sinner anyway, so we can let him do our dirty work. How can this immoral person be qualified to do a moral work, which God ordained, therefore it has to be moral, and yet we, as moral people, cannot do that moral work? It's irrational thinking. Paul took advantage of the government's protection. Acts chapter 23 and verse 16 to the end of that chapter. Paul's in the pokey. And the Jews have come up with this plot that if we can get them to move him to the city, we'll attack him on the way and kill him. You know, they hated him. They wanted to kill him. Well, guess what? His nephew heard about this, his sister's son. So he came and said, "Uncle Paul, these guys out there are making a plot against you. They're going to kill you." And what did Paul do? He said, "Never mind all that. We can't interfere with these matters. That's politics. That's up to the government. You know, let them just don't." No, read it. He said, "You need to go tell the captain of the guard here what you've heard." And he did so. And he went and told him, "Listen, centurion, there's a plot against my uncle, and they're going to kill him." And of course, by the time we get to the end of all this, they realize this plot, and they overthrew this plot to kill Paul. Now, Paul took advantage of the government's protection. If the plotters succeeded in attacking Paul, and the soldiers had to kill them to protect Paul, then would this have been immoral for them to do so? If so, why did Paul suggest that they do so? By calling upon their protection, and their protection might include killing the bad guys, Paul is calling upon them to do something immoral. Would Paul do that? I don't think so. Where is the consistency? 1 Timothy 2, verses 1 and 2. Here's the passage that says that, first of all, he says, I would that supplications and prayers and intercessions and thanksgiving may be made on behalf of all men, the kings and the governors and so on, so that we can live a peaceful and quiet life. In other words, do what we just did this morning during our worship, and that is pray for our government. Pray for the government leaders. And incidentally, the government can include our municipal government and our police and the soldiers and our national federal government. It includes everybody. So we're to pray for these people and pray that we can have a peaceful life. If the pacifist is correct, then sinners can do God's will while Christians pray for their success. It'd be all right for me to pray for the success of a sinner to do sinful work. This just cannot follow. Here's another way of putting that. Immoral people, the police or the government soldiers, can do a moral work for God while God's moral people, Christians, pray that the immoral people succeed. That's just inconsistent as can be. That doesn't make sense. Roseanne's sitting there shaking her head. You're exactly right. It's confusing and it makes no sense, that kind of point of view. What about personal protection? Is it immoral for a Christian to prevent sin by preventing a crime? Would crime prevention be immoral? How can it be? Crime is a sin. Is sin prevention immoral? How can it be? In view of Romans 12:18, since some men cannot be appeased, that's where he says, if it's possible, as much as within you lieth, be at peace with all men. Since some men cannot be appeased or will not be appeased, would it be immoral for a Christian to keep a thug from beating a woman or raping her, or keeping a kidnapper from taking his child for ransom? Would it be immoral to stop that? No, brethren, that would not be immoral to do that. We must intervene sometimes in some way. Would it be immoral for a Christian to keep a killer from taking his life? There he is. He's got his knife at your throat. He's threatening you with the gun. He's got the hammer pulled back. What are you going to do? Pull the trigger, buddy. I can't intercede. I can't do anything about this. Go ahead, stab. I'll tell you what, if you do it right here, I'll die faster and I won't feel as much pain. This cannot be. Proverbs chapter 3, verse 27 says, do good to those when it's in the power of your hand to do it. When you have the ability to do something good for someone, then do it. In light of this passage, crime prevention just might be, and many times is, the best good for that criminal. It's good to keep them from committing sin, because they might change their ways. Romans 12. You might have an opportunity to heat coals of fire on their heads by doing good to them. Not only preventing them from this terrible act that they were either involved in or about to do, but you might get them to think twice and maybe change their ways. Sometimes that's going to take intervention from you. Does God forbid Christians to protect themselves? Matthew 5, 38 and 39. What did Jesus mean by this? About turning the other cheek? What does this mean? Brethren, keep it in the context. Jesus is not dealing with self-defense from a thief or a thug. That's not what he's talking about. But he's talking about the oppression by a Roman soldier, by persecution, maybe because of your faith. That's what he's dealing with. This incidentally agrees perfectly with Romans chapter 12, verses 17 through 21. Agrees perfectly with it. Where it's an attitude you're dealing with, an insult you're dealing with, not necessarily a bad guy trying to kill you. This incidentally rules out vigilantism. We're not to take the law into our own hands as citizens of our nation. We're not supposed to do that. God doesn't allow us to do that. But it does not rule out self-preservation. Matthew 5:39 is not without qualification. As I said, let's keep these doctrines in the proper context. Did Jesus violate his own rule? If we conclude that turning the other cheek means you never stand up for yourself, Jesus broke his own rule. And I can prove it in John chapter 18, verses 19 through 24. Jesus is under arrest. He's being threatened with death. In John chapter 18, let's look at that. Beginning in verse 19. Let's see, 18, verse 19. The high priest therefore asked Jesus of his disciples and of his teaching. Jesus answered him, I have spoken openly to the world. I ever taught in the synagogues, in the temple where all the Jews came together. In secret spake I nothing. I've done everything open and above board. Why are you trying to trick me with this? You know everything I've been doing. Why ask thou me? Ask them that have heard me, that I spake unto them. Behold, these know the things which I said. And when he said this, one of the officers standing by struck Jesus with his hand, saying, Answerest thou the high priest so? He slapped him for his answer. Jesus answered him, If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why do you smite me? He stood up for himself. Listen, if I have told something I shouldn't have, you have every right to slap my mouth. But if not, why are you doing this? Ananias therefore sent him unto Caiaphas, the high priest. Jesus violated his own will. He should have remained silent, shouldn't have protested, shouldn't have said anything about that. Why did he not turn the other cheek? Why did he speak up for himself when he was slapped? And what did he mean by verse 36? Are you looking at it? What does verse 36 say about his servants? What would his servants do? They would fight. Wait a minute. No, wait. God teaches pacifism. Wait a minute. Or does he? My servants will fight? Would Jesus' servants really fight? Is this inconsistent of the Lord? No, my friends, it's not. The problem is pacifists have taken these passages out of their context. But let's look further. What did Paul do and say? Acts chapter 23, verses 1 through 5. He's under arrest. He's being questioned. And because of his answer, he was slapped. And what did he do in return? Why do you slap me, you whitewashed tomb? What do you think you're doing? Why didn't he turn the other cheek when he was slapped? Instead, he scolded that soldier. What about Matthew 5 and verse 44? Love your enemies. You've heard that it was said, Thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto thee, love thine enemies, and pray for them that persecute you. What did Jesus mean by this? The desire for the best, and that's the definition for love. This is the kind of word it is, to desire the good for somebody. To desire the best for an evil person does not place that evil person's actions above the welfare of yourself or your loved ones that this evil person is trying to harm. A rape's taking place. You're going to stand there? You're the victim of this rape. You're going to just lie there? When this person is doing this? Well, the Lord says, love my neighbor, so I can't do anything. Hogwash. That's not what Jesus meant here. One takes precedence over the other. We're not to harm out of hatred or practice vigilantism. If harming the villain is the only course to protect the innocent, then God authorizes it. It is an act of love for the one being harmed. Don't forget 2 Peter 2 and verse 12. That verse says this right here. These, as creatures without reason, born mere animals, to be taken and destroyed. Some people act like animals. And God says they're fit only to be destroyed. That doesn't authorize me to do it as a vigilante. But it does authorize me to protect myself and go through the channels the government has provided to take care of that villain. What about Peter and his sword? Matthew chapter 26, verse 52. Remember? Jesus being arrested. What did Peter do? Drew his sword and took a swipe at Malchus, the high priest's servant. What did he do? Struck off his right ear. We know that when we compare all the different passages about what's going on. What about this? Why did Jesus not tell Peter, throw away that sword. Don't you ever use a sword again. That's ungodly for you to use a weapon. But rather, he said, put it away. Why did Jesus not scold Peter about this? He says, those who take up the sword shall perish by the sword. What does it mean to take it up? There are basically two definitions. Number one, to take as a constant practice, typical, usual, as a habit. Like I may take up knitting. I doubt it, but I could. That's what that word means. That's part of what it means. In other words, here's the practice of always using the sword to make your point. And he says, there's really no purpose in that. Don't do that. Or to use as a tool at a certain time. There are times when I may need to use a sword for something. But he was not forbidding the use of a sword. Not at all. Jesus told his apostles to buy a sword. Luke 22, the parallel text, verse 36 and verse 38. He reminds them, you know, when I sent you out the first time, you didn't take anything with you and you had everything you needed. But the things are changing now. I'll tell you what. Be sure to have some extra money with you. Take an extra coat. In fact, you probably ought to sell that coat and buy a sword because of the work I have to set you to do. In verse 38, they said, Lord, here are two swords. And he said, that's enough. That's plenty. We can do with those. Why did he teach that? Why did he tell them that? What was about to happen? What's taking place? This. Jesus was about to be arrested. What did they ask Jesus when the soldiers came with Judas? Luke 22, verse 49, he says, Lord, shall we smite? Shall we fight? And you know what Peter did. He didn't wait for Jesus' answer. That's exactly what he did. He struck at that man and all was trying to, listen, why designate his right ear? Why was his right ear hit? Most people were right-handed. What was he trying to do there? I tell you what, I think he was trying to take his head off. That's what I think he was trying to do. And the man ducked and only hit his ear. Of course, Jesus healed that. Verse 51. Allow them to do this for now. He did not forbid. He did not scold. He said, let this take place because this is God's will. They need to arrest me. Don't interfere with this. This is all a part of my plan for your salvation. He simply said he bade them not to fight at this time. He did not forbid self-protection, nowhere in the scriptures. He did not forbid the innocent protecting another person. He made the point that this is a part of the Father's plan for your salvation, so let them have me. That's what happened in the garden. In no Bible text does God forbid his people to protect themselves from thugs, bullies, murderers, rapists, thieves, or other violent behaviors. God has not authorized, forbidden that for us to protect ourselves. So why buy a sword? Carnal weapons are not for carnal warfare. Are not for spiritual warfare. Carnal weapons are not for spiritual warfare. We know this from 2 Corinthians 10. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are divinely powerful, being used against those things that are lifted up against the knowledge of God. So we don't preach the gospel with a sword in our hand. This is the only sword in our hand that we use, sword of the Spirit. Again, Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 12, for our wrestling is not against flesh and blood, but against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Principalities and powers, that's what it's about. So we don't use carnal weapons for spiritual warfare. We don't teach and preach and convert by force. Islam does. Christianity does not. Catholicism used to. Christianity does not. That's not the way of God. To teach, preach, and convert by force. Carnal weapons are for carnal, bodily, physical protection. That's what they're for. They're protection for oneself and the innocent who need protection. And my brethren, if this is true of the individual, and it is, then why is it not true for a nation? Why did our young brother Will serve in the military? And others of you here probably, well, I know Richard did. Others of you, I know Hubert did. Why do that? Because you're authorized to do so. Not all people engaged in war are acting immorally. Some are trying to protect and preserve their nation or the welfare of an innocent third party, a nation that can't protect itself. Now, that opens the door for other debates, but we're just setting out the foundational principle here. So what's the second great commandment? Does everybody remember? Remember the first greatest commandment, right? What was the second one? Mark 12, verse 31, you must love your neighbor as yourself. There is no greater commandment than these, Jesus said in Mark 12, 31. So, I suggest this. You cannot love your neighbor if you do not love yourself properly. And you do not love yourself properly if you harm yourself or allow another to do so. And here's why I say that. Ephesians 5, verse 29, Paul says, for no man hateth his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it. Now that's the principle. What was he illustrating? How a man takes care of his wife. What? Takes care of his wife. What if she's being beaten? Takes care of his wife. What if she's being attacked? Take care of his wife. Not pacifism, protection. But it starts with how he feels about himself. How am I going to love my neighbor as myself if I don't take care of myself? Love your neighbor as yourself, incidentally, is found 9 times in the New Testament, and it is never taught as a reaction or a response to someone who's harming you. Ooh, ah, here he is, he's beating up on me. Oh, I got to love my neighbor as myself, and so I just got to take it. No, that's not when that's taught, my friends. It's taught as a proactive attitude towards people around you. I want to do what's best for you and best for you and best for these people out here in the world. It's similar to the golden rule, Matthew 7, 12. What's the golden rule? As you would have others do to you, do so also unto them. That's what loving your neighbor as yourself means. Here's a misinterpretation. When people use the golden rule, the second great commandment, turning the other cheek, loving your enemies, and so on, as justification for pacifism, is not correct biblical interpretation, nor is it proper application. To use these doctrines to allow a murderer, thief, kidnapper, rapist, or somebody else to do things that are wrong is in itself immoral. We're not to let sin pass. Not like that. We are from time to time called upon to protect ourselves, to protect the innocent, perhaps even to protect our nation. What is the Christian's role when it comes to pacifism? Does God demand peace at any cost? Do you know the answer yet? Here's the answer that seems reasonable to me. No, God does not demand peace at any cost. Yes, a Christian must protect himself, herself, and your families. Call upon the law to do their part, and when they're not available, you take care of yourself. Take care of your family. The best care that you can provide for yourself, first and foremost, is become a Christian. See to it that your soul is on safe ground, that it's held in the hand of God by your obedience to the gospel of his Son. Do you believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God? Make confession of that simple fact. Turn away from your sin or religious error and be buried with Christ in baptism. There you will have the newness of life and walk with God eternally. He'll make you a part of his church, his kingdom. And then we can engage in the spiritual fight that's set before us as we fight the good fight and war the good warfare of the faith until we finish the course, lay down our spiritual armor, and are carried home to victory. Brethren, if you have any needs that you need to make known to this congregation, let us know what they are. And if we need to pray for you, perhaps you need to make confession of error. Whatever the case might be, this is the time to let us know how we can help you while we stand and sing this song of encouragement.